So I remember getting some coaching advice years ago about the importance of building relationships before you discipline. And it was great advice that I knew it to be true. I mean, it makes sense. People are going to be a lot more open to feedback and accountability if they have a relationship with you. So with some of my challenging or problem players, as I would have called them, I started trying many different strategies to build a relationship with them so I could change them, right? I could change their behaviors. But these strategies, they didn't work. I mean, I struggled to build the relationships with many of these players. And why was that? Well, yes, before we discipline, we must build the relationship. But before we build the relationship, we've got to, as the Arbinger Institute teaches, we've got to get outside the box. We need an outward mindset. We need to see people as people. Today's episode is going to share the second part of our conversation with Sam Whitney from the Arbinger Institute. In the first part, we discussed the importance of seeing people as people, not as objects, obstacles, or irrelevant. When we see people as objects, obstacles, or irrelevant, we are what the Arbinger Institute calls inside the box. Leading or even just living our lives inside the box, it's ineffective and it's unfulfilling. Our relationships, they will suffer because people unconsciously sense the way that we are seeing them. And this is foundational for us as leaders, because if we try to lead from inside the box, it's just not gonna work. The strategies alone don't work, which is frustrating for me, honestly, as a person who's very action-oriented. When there is a problem, I want change. I want to change people. I want control. Getting outside the box, though, it's not a once-off thing. It's this daily, it's this lifetime challenge. And Sam Whitney is going to share some of Arbinger's keys to getting and staying outside the box. Welcome to the Coaching Culture Podcast, brought to you by Thrive on Challenge. I'm JP Nurbin, joined by my friend and co-host Nate Sanderson. Each week in about 30 minutes, we discuss important principles and strategies of transformational leadership. At Thrive on Challenge, we help coaches to raise the standards and strengthen the relationships in their program, because we know this type of culture produces better leaders, better people, and better results. To learn more about how we can help you, go to thriveonchallenge.com, where you can also subscribe to our weekly newsletter and get the coaching notes to every episode of this podcast.
If I'm listening to this and I'm wondering, have I been coaching from inside the box? And do I see my players as vehicles toward my own ends or obstacles for me to accomplish my own goals? How do I start to see people for people?
Right.
What is that process like? You know, it's when you become sort of self-aware, you've awoke for the first time in a sense. How do you start to see people differently?
That's a really good question, Nate. I think that's kind of the ultimate question when you learn about being in the box. You start to panic a little bit, going, well, maybe am I in the box? Oh crap, am I not seeing stuff? And the immediate question is, how do I get out? How do I get out? Because obviously it's not creating a good world for me to live in. And even as you hear about the box, it's kind of unnerving, because there's little moments where you go, oh shoot, that I've done that. Oh, I've done that. And it starts to resonate and it's scary. I think to get out of the box, the first and foremost step is to become just ravenously curious about other people. What one of the red flags of being in the box is that we assume we know other people. We assume that we know their motivations. We assume we understand what they're doing. And so when we're in the box, we just live with assumptions. When we're out of the box, and this is an important distinction right here I want to make, which is often people think being out of the box means to ascribe good intentions to other people. Just paint them into saints, right? Turn them into good people. Like, I'm driving on the freeway, someone cuts me off, and when I'm out of the box, I say, oh, they must be going to the hospital. And I just like throttle back and I'm okay. Like, that's not what out of the box means. It doesn't mean I swing the other direction and just suddenly start, because that's still being in the box. I'm still assuming that I know. I'm still treating them as an object. I'm not seeing them as a person. The key to being out of the box is to actually admit the fact that I don't know, to admit my ignorance and kind of go, I actually don't know what drives you, JP. I don't know what your life is like. I don't know why you do what you do. And so from out of the box, the first step is to admit the fact that I just don't know about people as much as I think I do. And to get let that ignorance kind of set in and go, that makes me really curious. So what the heck is going on in JP's life? I don't know. And then to set apart time to go learn. So as from a coaching framework, spending the time to know your players, right? Know your staff. Know them not only at the level of their game, but know them at the level of as people. It doesn't mean you have to go to their birthday parties and you have to know every little nitty gritty detail about their past. You don't have to cry together. Don't worry. It's not like we have to get together and sing Kumbaya. But the first step is to get radically curious about other people and then get curious about what my impact has been on you, right? Like if JP and I have been working together, JP, are there ways that I get in your way? Are there ways that I make things harder for you? You know, tell me, like, what way, if you could fix me right now, what would you say? And how can I get to that place? But I'd say, yeah, Nate, just to summarize, the first step is to really just get curious and acknowledge the fact that we don't know. We really don't know other people the way we think we do, right?
That's incredibly powerful. I remember hearing a story about how Kobe Bryant went to the New England Patriots training camp 2-3 years ago. And the culture coach brought him in at the time, and he was to speak to the Patriots. And so he sat down and he talked about what a great teammate was. And he says the number one quality of a great teammate, at least for Kobe Bryant, was curiosity. And it just kind of resonates, like just being curious about other people. Like that's like the first step. So it totally resonates, I think, with kind of, you know, the advice you're giving us there, which is pretty cool. Now, my other question here is we're leaders, and okay, yes, we're going to invest in ourselves. We're going to work to get outside the box. You know, we're going to be more curious. But at the end of the day, I know coaches are going, well, when people don't meet the standards, they have to be held accountable, right? And when they repeatedly, we have to get them to change. Is oftentimes, you know, like when we're talking about culture, like we're talking about behaviors. How do we do things here? Well, it's all about improving culture is getting people to change their behaviors is so often the approach that we take. So what would you say to coaches that are like, okay, I get that I'm inside, but I get outside the box, but I have to still hold my players accountable. So what would your kind of response to that be?
That's a really good question. Yeah. I think that when it comes to helping other people to change, it really depends on the level of influence that I wield with those people. Right. So if I wield a level of influence that's very small, I'll be very frustrated by my ability to change versus if I hold a lot of capital with an individual, I can ask them to make surprisingly large changes in their life and they will make them for me. To give you a kind of a framework for this, we have a structure in Harbinger called the Pyramid of Influence. If you imagine a pyramid with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 levels, the very top level, like imagine the food pyramid, the very smallest amount, the sugar level, right? We would label correction. The next level down, we'd level teach and communicate. And then we'd level the next one would be listen and learn. The next level would then be build relationships or build relationships with those who have influence. And the very bottom level, the largest possible part of the pyramid is called get out of the box or improve my mindset. And so again, people respond not to how we treat them, they respond to how we see them. And so when it comes to making a change, you know, the pyramid is actually telling me I should spend most of my time and energy at the lower levels of the pyramid, where there's more square footage is where I should spend my most time. And so from out of the box, when I'm trying to make a change, I understand that correction is the last thing I'm going to do. I'm actually going to spend more time and energy teaching a player, listening and learning, building a relationship and maybe trying to get out of the box with them. And so if we have a player, for example, that's just not performing, you can move down the levels of the pyramid to find a solution to it. You can say, look, that performance wasn't up to par. And I need to understand, does the player understand what my expectations are as a coach? If I clearly communicated the fact that I want them to do X, Y, Z, in many cases, at least in my world, I don't communicate my expectations as clearly as I think I should, as I need to. And a lot of people end up confused. Now, if I've communicated properly my expectations, they get it. They know what they're supposed to do. They're still falling flat. Let's get curious about why they didn't meet it. Is there something on at the core of their life? Is there something going on in their, and you know, something going on in the gym? Is there a relationship on the team that's hindering their ability to reach the goals I have for them? If there's nothing there, well, let's go down and let's build some relationships with them. Let's get closer to this player. Let's understand them and spend time with them. And then let's when it comes time to correct that person, I clearly communicated, I understand who they are, I'm out of the box with them, and now when I go to say, listen, you're letting us down, and if you're not playing at the level we need you to, now I'm in a position to set up with them a system of accountability, right? I can say, look, here's where I need you to be, here's where you are. Can you help me understand what you're willing to do to get to this level? Because if I can't get you here, I can't have you on the team. The rest of the team can't live, cannot succeed with you playing at this level. So for the benefit of everyone else on the team, we need you to rise. Can you do that? And what does that look like? And we set up an accountability system with that player, right? We actually help them nail down what those goals are going to be. And then we check in normally to do that. But I think the pyramid of influence allows us a pathway to confront lack of performance without actually generating more lack of performance. Because I can come at that from in the box and actually discourage a player from improving or squelch any potential that was there pretty quickly if I'm not careful. So,
no, it's what you're sharing is so like impactful. And that's one of my favorite tools that you guys share, because so much of that pyramid of influence we really work with our coaches on when it comes to, you know, building relationships, having great conversations and asking questions and making sure we're communicating standards, having them be a part of setting those standards. But just even pouring through your material in preparation for this conversation today, it just once again was a real kick in the teeth. Like, no, you have to be outside the box, because so often I remember years ago when I was gotten to coaching, it was like, okay, before you really want to get in there and discipline and correct kids, you got to build relationships. It's like, okay, what do I need to do to build a relationship? But then it always becomes so often for me was about, it was very manipulative. It's like, okay, I'm going to have this relationship so that I can come down hard on you. Not, I'm going to have this relationship because I see you as a person and because I value you as a human being. And if we like miss that first step, you know, we fall short so much on our ability to influence and to help others because we haven't seen them as people. And that's just, I just love that bit so much.
Well, you know, JP, one follow-up to that is that if you think about performance and loyalty and team player, being a team player, those are all things that the player has to give, right? They have to actually voluntarily give that stuff to the team and to the coach. You cannot extract it from them necessarily or force them to give it. And it, only when it's given authentically will it be at its highest potential level, right? It's when it's forced out of someone, it's at a half level or at a quarter level as they resist you. They still play, but they resist you while they're playing, right? And or they resist you while they're with the team or taking instruction. So there's this moment where we have to understand that it's the player that has to choose to give their best to the game or to the team. And as a coach, we need to get out of the way of that process, get out of the way of them being wanting to give that by being out of the box, like not creating resistance for that particular player or that team to do that. But so often as you're in the box trying to get them to change or improve, we're actually damming up the potential inside the player as they resist us and jump in their own box, right? We got to keep, it's not only important for us as a coach to stay out of the box, it's important to help our team stay out because that box is going to impact their performance massively, right?
Sam, we talked a little bit the other day in preparation for our conversation here about Arbinger's work, and a lot of what's been done has been done in the corporate setting, but you have worked with some sports clients or interacted with some in the sports realm as well. And I'm curious if you could just share maybe a success story or a story of impact in the sports world where you've seen either coaches or organizations really embracing this and having an impact on what they're doing in their programs and in their culture.
You know, the San Antonio Spurs, for example, I know that they as an organization read leadership and self-deception. And say what you will about the team, they're at least historically, they've been a bit of an older team. And their teamwork and their cohesion on the court is pretty amazing. Regardless of what you think about Popovich or their game style, they have the ability to take teams apart, and teams particularly that I think lean on one particular player. You know, a lot of teams lean on certain talent, but the Spurs, at least in my experience, have been able to get a real cohesion going and bring out a lot of talent in every player, or at least play to the strengths of a player. And something about that has to do with the fact that they are, I think, actively working on seeing each other as people, understanding that a point scored is a point for the team, not for my record. And that's an important mindset shift that I think that book brings to it. The second example would be Brigham Young University Hawaii soccer team. We worked heavily with them. They've got a coach there that works with them. They've been able to rise to the rank pretty high, pretty fast. They don't have an access to an incredible amount of talent. It's a pretty niche school. It's a religious school. And so they don't have a lot of talent to work with. And if there's any BYU Hawaii players listening, I no offense, but you don't have access to a ton of talent. So it's not like they can lean on a ton of talent. But and in their work with Arvinger, what they've been able to do, they really embed it in the player culture. So the players go through workshops and the players work with a coach to try and get out of the box to understand that collusions and the box can be the most detrimental thing to team cohesion. Because in that moment when you're playing, I mean, so much happens split second decision making in a player situation where you're in a high intensity situation in the middle of a play. And suddenly when you look across the field to pass to a player that's open, a teammate that's open, and you're in the box with that teammate, you're going to be weighing whether or not they deserve the pass as a person relative to me. And that's something that's like, oh, that does happen to you when you're playing. You don't just see a player that's open. You see an enemy perhaps, or someone who's an obstacle to my performance, or someone who said something I didn't like before, someone I don't like, or I don't get along with, versus there's another extension of myself. Like when players can see each other as extensions of themselves, just simply as part of a self-organizing unit, and someone gets open, it's like a no-brainer pass. Or when players are able to watch the entire game fully dedicated to the success of the team rather than only to their own success, they're not just looking for opportunities to score points for themselves. They're looking at how can they shape the game together? How can they move as one cohesive unit? How can they pick up the trash over here? How can they, you know, pull a player who's open into a better position? Like everyone becomes kind of a captain when they're out of the box versus just another player. And I think the cool part of BYU Hawaii, the interviews that I've seen come out of their team, particularly the women's team, has been the level of responsibility they each take for the success of everyone around them, which I think is really cool, versus just thinking about their own score or their own future. Because a lot of these players are looking to graduate into club teams in the MLS or into other divisions in the pro levels. And there's a lot of pressure on players to perform and to score points and to have stats of their own, versus just their team stats, right? And one other example I like to share is with a group called Peace Players International. They actually leverage Arvinger's work in high conflict areas through basketball. So they'll go to North Ireland or they'll go to Israel-Palestine and put girls in particular or young people on teams together. So Palestinians, Israelis on the same team, Catholics and Protestants on the same team, you know, and have them play basketball, but teach them Arvinger concepts through the anatomy of peace as they play. And not only do they play well, of course, but the relationships built and the generational conflict divides are bridged on these teams, and peace is created through sport. But it's not just the basketball that gets them there. They actually have to drill into them that this other girl, for example, from Palestine is a person, or this Israeli girl is a person. And it really makes a difference in their success.
Sam, I really appreciate some of the examples you shared there, because I mean, I think about one of the hottest topics in most college and high school sports today is even the issue around playing time, you know? And it's like when a player is upset that they're not getting their playing time that they feel like they deserve, that they've earned, or they're, you know, talented enough to get. I mean, it's really, they're really inside the box because they're not seeing their teammates as people. They're just, you know, if they could stop to say, well, she's playing or he's playing instead of me, and you know, they may have worked hard, or, you know, but just, I think that there's so much value in that if we're able to, because I think that's really kind of at the core of the problem. It honestly is that, you know, it's all about me and it's only looking to, and then you start to get players justify their own behaviors. They lash out their teammates, they lash out their coach, you know, they get their parents sending nasty emails to coaches and stuff like that. So I just think there's a lot of value in that as well.
I couldn't agree more. And think about, what's funny is that the player who's lashing out about not getting enough playing time, are they inviting the coach to want to put them in the game at all? I mean, like, that doesn't serve their purpose. And that's the funny part, is who in their right mind would actually sabotage their ability to get at their goals via their behavior? And the answer is, well, maybe they're not always in their right mind, right? Maybe they're not actually seeing it really clearly. And if they were to be outward and helpful and a team player and rejoice in just the sport itself and in being part of it, that coach would want to put them in the game. They'd be like, yeah, I want to get you in here. I want to help you. Because not only does the coach have an impact on the players by virtue of this material can have an impact on the coach and on their position within the team, right? And how they play, and creating a more cohesive unit is fully within their control. And actually getting at more playing time might be more more possible if they were just out of the box, right?
I just have one last question kind of before we let you get out of here today. And that is, you obviously work for Arbinger, and I'm just curious what that experience is like. What's the culture of Arbinger, and how do these principles and values, you know, how do they manifest there? And what is that? Because we're always about the experience and creating an experience for our players that feels great, you know, that helps them to grow. So I was just curious if you could share a little bit about Arbinger's culture and what it means to you.
Yeah. You know, Arbinger's cult, it's funny because we grapple with this stuff and we feel embarrassed more often than other cultures because it's like, ah, crap, we're in the box again, or ah, crap, we're you know, doing this and we're not living up to it. And frankly, there's always that misunderstanding that I think is so, the box is something that's pernicious, and our need to feel justified as people is constant. It's always there, and it's always hard to get out of. And it's a hard thing to battle with because, for example, it's possible to feel like I'm being outward, but you'd be in the box. Like that same thing of, I'm just going to be nice and accommodating to everybody. Well, that's not out of the box. That's not actually being helpful. Are we pushing forward objectives? Are we actually succeeding as an organization? So there are many times we get into meetings and we just kind of listen to each other and nothing gets done. And it's like, well, crap, but that's not an outward meeting. That was an inward meeting where everyone was pretending to be really nice and really accommodating, and it's not actually helpful. We get into other meetings where we argue and it's like, well, shoot, maybe we're not out of the box as much as we thought we were. You know, I've had one great experience. I mean, I just say that because we struggle like everybody. So don't worry if the Arbinger's not this bastion of outwardness that's floating above the clouds and I have to take a jetpack up every day to get up there. It's like, it's something we struggle just like every other organization. It is helpful though, where, you know, Arbinger is very open to the opinions and the input of every team member, regardless of where they stand in the organizational hierarchy. And so it's taken very seriously. Every idea is taken seriously. Arbinger's really good at listening, really good at taking things into account. We're really good at, we really don't fight very often. There's not a lot of politics in the office. It's very straightforward, and you're given a lot of opportunity to advance your own career via taking responsibility for your role, right? And having those conversations that need to be had. And so we're given the tools to actually step outside of the normal structure of, I have to wait for a promotion. I have to wait for a raise. I have to wait for more responsibility. It's like, you can just straight up walk into the CEO's office and say, look, I need to be doing more. And I think I can do the following. And he will hash it out with you, right? And it's like, it'll work. The other thing is that, for example, in meetings, it's come up. One time, I remember a year and a half ago, we were in a meeting and the meeting was getting heated and we weren't getting anywhere we wanted to go. One of the juniorest members of the team raised his hand and said, look, I think we're all in the box here. I think we need to take a step back and leverage the pyramid and cool off for a minute and then come back to this with some clear objectives of how we're going to help each other. And it was like the meeting stopped instantly and everyone was like, you're absolutely right. Yep, it's totally true. And the one team that was mad at the other team, we all just kind of started laughing at each other and with each other. And we were like, yeah, shoot, we're totally in the box. And we said, we're going to stop the meeting. We'll come back next week and we'll do it again with a better. So we do have access to some great tools that really help us to untangle some knots. But we do get into some sticky situations still, like everybody. So no worries.
Your answers prompted me to ask one more question. So I'm sorry, sure. But when I went through this, you know, started reading Leadership and Self-Deception, obviously I tried to apply it to my coaching. I tried to apply it to even the classroom, you know, as a teacher. But probably where it's most prevalent for me, and especially over the last few days as I'm in another lockdown here in Ireland with my three kids and wife, is to apply it with my family. And so I'm just curious, is this something you openly talk about in your marriage? You know, obviously your kid's a little bit younger, so I don't know if your five-year-old knows what the box is yet. But I'm just curious because I think so much of what we try to work with coaches on, we also, through our mentorship program, try to help them leverage these principles within their other relationships that are, you know, really, really important to them.
Yeah, that's a phenomenal question. I think that there isn't a divide between coaching and work and home life. We're all integrated. And so it's an important thing to ask about. I think, I found that talking about Arbinger principles explicitly with my wife doesn't go well, particularly when I see that she's in the box, right? It never helps to be like, honey, I think you're in the box. However, the most, and I think this goes for everywhere you apply Arbinger, pointing out someone else's box is never going to work. Like, people are going to go, ah, like, they're just going to resist that. And my wife in particular has been very good at being like, don't use that arbiter crap on me. Right? Like, I get it. She knows. No, I'm kidding. It's fine. I think it's most impactful in the marriage in the sense that when I try to live it, like when I don't talk about it, I just try to live it. So I try to, you know, I've had experiences where my wife will jump in the box and I know she's in the box. And it's just resisting the invitation. She'll do little things to try to get me in the box too, try to pick a fight here or there. And it's like, nope, I'll just be helpful to you. And I'll try to take a look around and go, what haven't I been doing? Why is she feeling the way she's feeling? And maybe even check in with her and say, look, hey, I apologize. Like, I definitely promised to take the kids to this thing. And I definitely promised to do that thing in the house. And I didn't. And I just remembered and I'm sorry. I'm going to do it. And then immediately it'll diffuse. Or just say, you know, look, I feel like you're having a tough day. Do you want to just talk about something? You know, is something on your mind? And just listen to her rather than get into defensive mode and fight back. Because living this material with people we live with is so hard because they know our buttons really well. And there's history there they can draw upon. And there's expectation embedded in that, right? Between marriages, it's hard. And so I find that to the extent that I'm able to live it, I'm able to invite her out of the box. And every single time she's like, wow, thank you for just talking to me. I'm sorry I was the way I was. And she's always she always apologizes later, realizes where she was, just as I do when I realize I was in the box in some moment, right? I'll come back and say, and my wife ends up applying the same thing to me. She ends up mirroring that, and she knows the material, and she'll call it out too. She's like, hey, I think we're in a collusion. I'm not seeing you. What are you trying to do? And it's been great to have those tools. With my kids, really quickly, yeah, talking about the box doesn't work with a five-year-old. They don't understand what that is. However, there are ways in which on two kind of angles. One, she is watching and absorbing the way that my wife and I interact. So she's picking up scripts of what's acceptable versus not acceptable. Like, she's picking up the way that I talk about other people. She's talking about she's picking up ways I talk about people I disagree with. I mean, we have political conversations in our home all the time. It's like everybody, you know, talking about things you disagree with, things you want to have happen, different aspects of life. And she's picking that up. So I got to be very careful to model those conversations in an out of the box way, to not be blaming, not be calling people dumb or stupid, or, you know, going and belittling and objectifying others. The second aspect is she's already picking up and starting to blame other things besides herself, right? The other night she got out of bed and was playing around up here in our top floor where she shouldn't be. She was supposed to be in bed and she was sneaking around. And I came up and I put her back to bed and she's like, but I was doing this and Jonah, my brother, her brother, Jonah did this and I don't have a nightlight and I'm thirsty. And she just got all these reasons for why she was up. And I just stopped her and said, no, you're up because you chose to get up. And that's why you're in trouble. Not because of Jonah, not because of the water, not because of the light, but like trying to help her kind of take responsibility for the fact that she did something that she chose to do. It wasn't like not lending to her a license to justify, to jump in that box herself. And that's going to play out into teenagerhood. You know, kids come home and complain about their problems. My wife and I talk about how do we help our kids stay out of the box when they come home and we only get one side of a story, right? Like, my kid got hit at school. Am I going to jump up and run over the school and scream and shout? Or is it like, am I going to ask the question, well, did you do anything? Were you involved in this in any way? Mm-hmm. And how are you a problem for this other person? How are you going to fix it? And what are you going to do? You know, and helping to empower them to do that. I don't know. But I think it's super applicable at home. I think it's a great testing ground. And JP, for you, you've got little kids, and Nate, it's just like daily practice is like so visceral. It's so good.
Thanks so much to Sam for joining us on the podcast. I want to share quickly two things that I would recommend for every listener. First, read Leadership and Self-Deception. It's powerful. It was a really hard book for me to read because I started to become aware of certain things about myself that I didn't like. Heck, things that other people didn't like about myself. Secondly, though, I would just encourage you to try to build the daily discipline of journaling. Like, in the last 5 years, it has been foundational for me in building other healthy habits and disciplines within my life, but also it helps me to intentionally reflect. I have quite a few prompts that I reflect on, but I have three specific questions that I answer daily in my journal. One, what am I grateful for? Two, what is the most important thing today? And three, who in my life am I inside the box with? For me, I call that a heart posture check. But once again, like journaling, I can't recommend it enough. If you would like to build the habit, but you struggle, just shoot me an email. I have a journaling system PDF with some ideas that might help you. My email is in the details of this episode as always. And as always, thank you for listening to the podcast. Please remember to subscribe, leave a review, and share the episode with friends and on social media.